So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
Today, we'll be chatting about the latest news from Computex 2021, which is still happening. We're not in Taipei like we normally are to go cover this thing, but there's a lot of virtual stuff happening. Yeah, sigh. I'm going to ask you more about that, Sherlyn,
yes.
In a bit. But yeah, we'll have some news from NVIDIA, AMD, and Intel, and any other fun stuff. And we've got a bunch of other small news bits that happened this week that seem really exciting too. And we'll be chatting with our podcast producer, Ben Elman, throughout the show too. So hey, Ben, how's it going?
Hello.
Be sure to stick around for the end of this episode where our managing editor, Terrence O'Brien, chats with Alessandro Cortini from Nine Inch Nails about developing a new instrument, the Strega. As always, please subscribe to the Engadget Podcast on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoy the show. That's always helpful. And you can always check us out, broadcasting live every Thursday morning around 10 a.m. Eastern, typically. You can also drop us a note at podcast@engadget.com. We'd love to take your questions. We can mention it on the show even in the future. If you want to record a voice memo or something too, shoot it to that email. Maybe we can plug it into the show. Let's get straight to Computex. And let me just say, Sherlyn, I'm very sad.
I know this is your favorite show.
It is my favorite show. I think it's our favorite show because Computex is a show that both you and I have been covering together for the past couple of years now. We fly 16 to 18 hours from New York to Taipei. We spend a whole week in Taipei and we're just surrounded like by PC hardware, but also surrounded by great food and, you know, the beautiful city of Taipei and
insane
just
weather.
Being in a very different place. And insane weather, which I love.
I do not.
I know you hate, Sherlyn. Just super, super humid weather. But the whole thing about Computex, which you guys may not get when we write about it and when we talk about it, is that it is an experience in Southeast Asia. And I just miss that whole experience. So being, you know, up late covering news that's happening remotely is not nearly as fun. And also, you were on vacation, Sherlyn, so you missed out on a lot of this fun time, too.
Yeah, I normally Computex is like kind of my trip back to Asia every year. And so not doing it this year is... It's not just like a work like thing that I'm missing out on, but also, you know, family time and
family time. Yeah. Well, it's been 2 years. We didn't even go last year either. There was no Computex last year.
But virtual Computex, there was still a lot of news. But you know what surprised me is that like the sheer amount of news that came out of like chip companies, but hardly any other company, in my opinion. Like, I have more stuff in my purview at Computex to cover. I have Acer, Asus stuff.
Yeah, you have more systems to cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a little bit, not so much of the hands-on experience at least, right? On the video side of things.
We hit
a lot of press release stuff. But anyway, I'm happy to get down into it.
I feel like in terms of news, this was more of like half of Computex is like PC components and the nitty-gritty hardware stuff that both Sherlyn and I really like. And not just systems, not just like consumer gadgets. This one, since it's virtual, I think it's just mainly components. So let's start with some news from NVIDIA, which I think was the biggest news of this event. They announced the new RTX 3080 Ti and 3070 Ti desktop GPUs. These things are massive and powerful. I have a review up of the 3080 Ti on the site right now. They're also really expensive, or at least the 3080 is. It is $1,199.
$1,199.
That's compared to the plain 3080, which is $699.
And so what's the difference?
That is $500 more. So the big difference is it's just a lot more powerful. So the I think the way a lot of people are describing this is that it is sort of like the RTX 3090, which is NVIDIA's insane $1,499 video card, which I can't even imagine having that in my system. But it is sort of like a lot of the power from that chip scaled down to the cooler and hardware that more resembles the RTX 3080. So it is faster. And I definitely noticed that in my testing, especially when it comes to like ray tracing performance. You know, for a game like Control, where I am always just trying to crank how hard my system can go, this thing was able to run Control in 4K with NVIDIA's DLSS technology, rendering everything at 1440p. And DLSS sort of like takes low resolution textures, it uses AI processing to upscale them to a better resolution. So it was able to do that plus high ray tracing settings. So that's like all the visual niceties, just really beautiful graphical flourishes, and still run the game above 60 FPS. It was like 70 to 80 FPS. That is kind of remarkable because Control is just like, it is a demanding game. It is sort of like the crisis of our time, crisis in terms of the game crisis. This thing handles ray tracing so well, but I think in other things, in some benchmarks, and certainly in games like Destiny 2, the performance bump was like 10% over the RTX 3080. And I don't think that is worth a $500 premium. You know, like it is a tough thing. And as we're talking about all this stuff, I don't know if you've noticed this, Sherlyn, but the video card market is insane. Everything is insane right now. So whatever prices NVIDIA is putting out.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, all the PC and chip markets are insane, but GPUs in particular, right? More. We are in a world where a card that's supposed to be $500, like the RTX 3070, is now selling on eBay for $1,500.
It's crazy.
You know? Everything is out of stock at every store, and even if you can find a GPU in a store, you're still going to be paying above market price, basically. So this is a bad time to buy GPUs. NVIDIA is saying this card will be $1,199, maybe for the lucky few who can get it early. But if you're buying it later, if you're buying it from a reseller, you're going to be paying a lot of money for that. I've seen people pay over, I think, like $2,000 for the RTX 2080 Ti, which is several years old right now, but still really powerful. Just a bad time. The GPU market is sort of like a fantasy right now. We talk about these prices.
Can we check back in about why that is, actually? So a few episodes ago, I was stupidly thinking that, okay, it was cryptocurrency that was still controlling the price of that market. That is not the case. Again, that's probably not the case. Is it that it's just production slowdowns because of the pandemic?
It's everything. It's everything. So it is production slowdowns. It is increased demand from gamers who are still like reeling from not being able to get a GPU because of all the crypto miners. These new cards and a lot of NVIDIA's new hardware is hash limited, which means you can't use them for a lot of cryptocurrencies. So that is one way to like keep them out of miners' hands. But they still can't make enough. Scalpers are still out there buying these things immediately and reselling them at a really high price. So it's like the market is just really unbalanced right now. And I think we got to wait maybe to the end of the year until things kind of sort themselves out. So that's just the thing. You know, I'm talking about all these GPUs. I'm reviewing these things. It is weird to be reviewing a thing where once it actually hits the market, will probably be much more expensive than the price the company is saying. And we mentioned all this in our reviews. You know, it is a tough thing to juggle. It's still news that these things exist. It's not like the cards aren't made up. It's more like the pricing is made up, basically, or at least the pricing is determined by the market, which is volatile.
So is it possible that there's the other part of like the stock market is really hot and some people think that it might be because people are putting their stimulus checks into meme stocks or something? Is it possible that there are also just tons of gamers who've been saving their stimulus for these new graphics cards?
Maybe a possibility, and maybe that's going to allow some gamers to pay a lot more than they should for these GPUs, but we can't lay everything at the hands of the stimulus checks. Like, those are very small amounts of money compared to the size of this market and like the scale scalpers work on these days. So I from what we're seeing, that is going to have a bigger effect. But anyway, we did on Engadget's upscaled series on YouTube, Chris Schott did a breakdown of these new NVIDIA GPUs and kind of what they mean. So go check that out. It's definitely worth watching. I'm really digging the 3080 Ti. I'm not digging this retail price. And I think for a lot of people, you know, TLDR, I think the RTX 3080 is the better deal when it comes to a powerful GPU at $699. Honestly, the 3070, which was supposed to be a $499 card, is really powerful, really like performs really well. That thing is like the best balance of price and performance. I wish these cards were selling at their retail prices. You cannot find it at the retail price. You can't find it at all. Don't buy a GPU now, folks, if you can avoid it.
My favorite analogy for all of this has been that, like, graphics card nerds finally understand what it feels like to be a sneakerhead. And, like, they might as well make, like, Nike-style apps for these cards, like, for, like, fresh drops. And, like, the next thing you know, NVIDIA is going to have, like, a physical retail store and people are going to be lining up around the block for, like, a card. The way you would see people, try to buy. Can you imagine, like,
people have been lining up. I can. People have been, you know, the way sneakerheads like just like lay up like 100 boxes of shoes and be like, look what I got.
I know.
People definitely line up. I've seen photos online of people just like showing off all the cards they got and be like, yeah, I'm going to sell this for 500%, you know, over what I paid or something. It is a mess right now. One thing I'd recommend, and we're going to move on to AMD side of things. But if you're building a new computer, and your GPU is just kind of like this hole in your setup right now that you can't fill, you could consider one of AMD's new APUs, which are their CPUs that have a bit of Radeon graphics on them. And at Computex, they also announced like two of the APUs, two of the 5000 series APUs are going to be on sale in August. So that's going to be nice. And I think like that is a way for you to like build a computer, be able to plug in a monitor, play a simple game if you wanted to, but just basically build a computer and then wait, just sit there and wait for a GPU. Like that is the thing. But hey, folks, if you can wait, please wait, because this market is insane. I think the only way to ensure you get a new card is if you buy a complete system. And that is something I've seen a lot of other people do too. It's like, yeah.
Question, are there a lot of new systems with this new card coming out or being announced? Because I think I saw a whole slew of news go up around Monday or Tuesday morning.
There was a lot of news. I mean, not with the NVIDIA cards. Like, okay. We haven't desktops. We don't. So the way we cover desktops and notebooks is, I think, really different. Yeah, we don't really look at desktops because it is really easy for a company to just roll out a new desktop case and slap in, you know, a video card or something on it. So, but for a notebook, it is a lot harder and it takes a lot more power. And by the way, speaking of notebooks, I think it is really cool that AMD announced they're getting more serious about mobile graphics, which is really interesting. They announced the Radeon RX 6000M series GPUs, which I think this is the first time AMD has really taken on the high end when it comes to mobile gaming, because typically that's been NVIDIA's domain. And even with last 2 years' chips, the 5000 series, those things debuted on the MacBook Pro. They debuted, you know, I reviewed it on the MacBook Pro 16-inch. They're great for workhorse PCs, but they were never gaming GPUs. So I think things are going to be really interesting now. What do you think, Shilin? Like, are you excited by the idea of, you know, AMD and Radeon graphics being a bigger player in notebooks in general?
I'm more just kind of like, and we'll get to this later, I guess, but I'm more kind of just looking at Intel struggling around with its Xeon and like all of its other graphics options, going like, you know, this will probably spur the overall chip market.
You
to
mean
try
XE?
Harder.
XE?
XE. Yeah, I said Xeon. XE but graphics. In my head.
Xeon is layer like server chips.
That's what I call, the Intel Iris XE. I just filled it out with Xeon. Anyway. I think competition.
I'll talk about Intel soon because they do have some stuff coming. Yeah. but hey, we're going to have a review soon. It's sitting right next to me right now. I have one of the first computers with the Radeon 6800M mobile graphics. It is the Asus ROG Strix G15, which is a big honkin' fella. It is like a 6-pound gaming laptop. So it is like a serious gaming laptop. I think typically I like to review the ones under 5 pounds. I like to review the gaming laptops that are trying to be like thin and light and do everything. But it is really nice to have a system that's just like, I don't care about being thin. Just, you know, give me all the power. And this thing is super powerful. So I'm interested in reviewing this and testing this further and seeing how this works. I'll also note there's like there are a couple other advantages of having Radeon graphics, AMD's Radeon graphics, and AMD CPUs in the same system. They announced like Smart Shift. They have actually talked about this before. They have Smart Shift and Smart Access technology. Smart Shift basically lets the computer balance where power is going in the system, so it can more intelligently send power to the CPU or send power to the GPU that leads to more performance. Or the other one is smart access. That gives the CPU direct access to the memory that is sitting on the GPU. And these GPUs tend to have a lot of like VRAM on their own too. So AMD is saying like that alone, that feature alone can lead to a 10% performance bump of running that hardware without smart shift. So I think these little like incremental gains are really nice too. You know, with these GPUs, your laptops are basically turning into the PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X, you know, because those machines are basically AMD CPUs with Radeon graphics, you know. So we're just kind of breaking all that down. I think it's going to be a really exciting year for gaming notebooks.
Yeah.
Is this something you're taking a closer look at, Trillin?
Do
you want to be a gaming notebook person?
I mean, the thinner they get, right? 5 pounds is still like not my realm, right? The laptops I review are like
that's portable for gaming. Yeah.
I know. So like with what fans and cooling systems and whatever, obviously they're hunking beasts that, you know, back in the day when I used to tote laptops around in the purse, those were not for me. Now, though, I live, bro, so I can probably take on your 5 pound machines. I also think that when it comes to gaming, of all the different types of, you know, platforms there are, PC versus console, I've just been more inclined towards PC, even though I think like a controller, the controls are better with the proper like console controller.
You can always
link one up. I have the Stadia one, which we shall not talk about. But I just don't play that many games on PC at the moment, other than, and this is a fun fact, I just learned Settlers of Catan, a board game that I can also play online. So that is me, PC gaming, League of Legends, and Catan. So I don't think I need AMD's power for that.
Who knows? Like, so we've also covered, and we're going to talk more about Intel too, but we've talked about like Intel's Xe graphics, you know, and that is their new onboard built-in integrated graphics. And maybe you don't need a full dedicated GPU. Maybe you just need a little something that can let you play
Their integrated graphics,
The Sims or something. Right. Yeah. So that's all. I think that's getting better too. I think maybe AMD is going to be better about getting its Radeon APUs too, or the Ryzen APUs, again, Ryzen CPU plus Radeon graphics in a single chip, putting that together, you know, that could be useful for laptops as well. We've seen that work really well over the last few years. Basically, it's an exciting time to get a laptop, bad time to start building a desktop. How about that? Let me put that out there, just because these markets are so crazy right now when it comes to video cards. At least on the laptop side, you're not paying crazy prices. And the hardware is like new and interesting, you know. Speaking of laptops, I just want to quickly shout out, Intel announced 2 new U-series chips. And these are, they have different lines, right? Like they have the U-series, which are for like ultra portables and super thin and light computers. And they have the H-series chips, which are more powerful, and those are going to be the ones you find in gaming laptops and like workhorse machines. These new U-series chips, they finally have some, they still top out at 4 cores, but they finally have one that hits 5 gigahertz on a single core. So a bit of a performance bump there. That is Intel trying really hard to compete with like AMD's latest Ryzen 5000 series chips. And really now the war in computers in general, like both on desktops and laptops, but AMD's really making a play for power, you know, like especially when it comes to multi-core performance and things like that. So the war is heating up. I think our computers are going to get a lot more interesting. Are you excited by any of this?
I do want to say, like, I think that a lot of the time when we go to Computex, in the last few years, at least, I've noticed this pattern of like companies trying to, you know, take Intel's lunch, and AMD has been doing it for years and seems like it's finally there. Like, you know, it used to be like, oh, I'll take an appetizer, oh, I'll take a snack, and I was going for the full main course. and usually when we're at Computex, some of the stuff that I cover at least is 5G stuff and Qualcomm is one of the companies that usually has a big showing there at Computex. I'm trying to just make sure I can talk about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see also Qualcomm go for Intel's desktop or laptop, you know, business by trying to announce PCs cards for PC. It's based on the ARM. And I just bring it up because I think my mind went right to, like, you can't talk laptop chips without talking about Apple's M1 anymore nowadays.
For sure.
And once we talk about that, like, the idea is, will these cards that just got announced by AMD, for example, I mean, the ones in the laptop category, anyway, can they compare to Apple's M1? Do you think there is potential? Do you think Apple's still going to...
Well, it's like, it's very different things, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what we like about the M1 is that it is great, fast, efficient ARM hardware. Apple has its own graphics cores that they plugged in there. So it is, that's actually very similar to AMD's APUs, you know, their chips that have combined everything.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's like a very different thing, but certainly I do think the PC industry in general, and we'll talk about this when we get to the new Windows news, but I think the PC industry in general needs to start taking ARM hardware and ARM software more seriously, because that is like the new standard that Apple put out there, you know?
Yeah. I think we're going to see more. I just don't know if it's coming on the PC side as quickly as it is on Apple. By PC, I meant kind of like Windows.
It definitely... Yeah, because PCs are so many things, right? Apple is a single company, and it can like lay down a rule and be like,
yes,
we're going to move to this. You know, yes, everyone's doing this. Yeah, that's the benefit of controlling both the hardware and software side of the equation. It is much harder for the rest of the PC market where, yeah, Microsoft has the software. There's so many developers that don't want to listen to what Microsoft is doing. There's so many competing different hardware things too. Like the way I think of these companies, Intel, NVIDIA, and AMD, it's just like a triad of frenemies.
Yeah.
You know, like it is all like, oh, I'm going to shake your hand while I have a gun pointed to your head. And I have like a knife I'm holding in my foot pointed at another enemy, because they're always like fighting, but also always working together. So it is very confusing. You know this, Sherlyn. Like, yeah, it is a weird thing. Just a couple years ago. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, don't forget that commercial we were talking about, Intel's commercial, just recently. That's such a frenemy Pagro move, but go ahead.
A couple years ago at CES, Intel and AMD announced they were working together on a chip. They put Radeon graphics on a chip alongside Intel's, I think it was 8th or 9th gen CPUs. It was a single chip that showed up in Nooks. It showed up in some, you know, a handful of computers. Then they ended that immediately once Intel got its own graphics capabilities. You know, also once Intel stole away the head of graphics from AMD Radeon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like there's all sorts of drama going on here. Intel is hard at work at building its own like dedicated GPU. We've seen like examples of that. We've seen their integrated GPUs kind of like get better and better over the last few years, so the Xe graphics are actually pretty good. But yeah, everybody is both fighting together. Intel sold its 5G modem technology, right, to Apple, but they also announced that they're working together with MediaTek on like a 5G thing that can be plugged into computer. It is all very confusing. So anyway, that was another part of the Intel news. Basically, Intel and MediaTek have a 5G M.2 module that PC makers can just plug into their laptops and boom, you got 5G.
Good for them.
Good for them. I don't care about sub 6 gigahertz, you know, megahertz. I don't care about sub 6 5G really, but that's all they're going to be able to do.
Yeah, that to me is like until you get to millimeter wave, the gains are not that obvious. And MediaTek doesn't seem to have Qualcomm's muscle when it comes to millimeter wave, and not to mention all the tech in between. So we'll see.
Okay, that's it for Computex news. Let's move on to some other news.
So another company we always see at Computex is Microsoft. They always have this big keynote that you and I go to this dingy auditorium, I guess, for to listen. But they did
it's
also
the same. Oh, man. It is the same auditorium we just go to every time. It is kind of, let me just say, it is. Let me paint a picture for you, right? Like, if you imagine, like, it is a major, it reminds me of like a college lecture hall, because it is like a big thing and they have the pullout
the tables
that are next to, you know, next to the seat, so you can sit there and take notes. Thank God, because I'm there usually writing a lot. But yeah, Microsoft usually does this thing where they're like, hey, we're Microsoft and we, you know, we help make PCs possible. They rarely have actual news. Nope. It is always like trying to pull teeth to get news from Microsoft at Computex. But so I guess they're not at Computex, but something
this
else,
week
right?
They dropped some surprise news. I think you were like already kind of like super wiped from writing so much news for this week for Computex. But Microsoft was like, nope, we're going to kill Devendra some more by dropping this surprise announcement.
At the end of my news shift, by the way. Like, I had already written other news that day.
Exactly. On, like, what was it? Wednesday, I believe. But anyhow, so Microsoft is holding another event. I wouldn't say another. I don't think, actually, Microsoft has held a lot of events throughout the pandemic. Mm-mm. But anyway, on June 24th, Microsoft plans to unveil what it's saying is the next Windows, or the event name is What's Next in Windows, which is very interesting to hear. I'm not sure if we're going to, because we just heard about the death of Windows 10X. This is a very timely announcement, right? To be like, Windows 10X is dead. What's next? We just had Build.
Yeah. We were just at Build. And that, the Windows 10X news also came out of Build, I believe, too. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing. So Satya Nadella, and Build was just last week. This is all happening so quickly. Satya Nadella teased last week that, they are working on the next generation of Windows. He's been using it for a while. He's very impressed by it. The question is, like, where does Microsoft go from here?
Right.
Because I think Windows 10 was super successful for them. I reviewed that back in 2015, and it is, like, it's a great OS. I use it, like, that's my primary OS every day when I'm not using, like, the work laptop or something, because it's a Mac. But the question is, like, what is next? And they talked about dual screens and things like that for Windows 10X. That is kind of dying off, or at least being subsumed by the rest of Windows 10. But I almost wonder, too, if, like, the next version of Windows is just going to take in a lot of what they were planning for 10X and just make it a little more system ready for dual screen devices and other things. Also, maybe they have to just completely rebuild Windows to work better on ARM. How about that? And I feel like that is the big push here. Like, that is, I'm sure Microsoft saw Apple's M1 chips and saw how easily macOS translated to ARM and how their emulation of Intel apps was astoundingly fast. Like, Apple is just, like, out there throwing body blows to Intel and AMD. And I do think Microsoft had to be like, oh, we gotta do better.
Yes.
We gotta fix this.
Yes.
So that is my personal bet. What do you think?
I mean, I think you are right on the money there. I think that not just the thing that you said about ARM-based Windows being potentially what they're going to show, because, like you said, like, look, we were just talking about this, like, PCs are, you know, trending towards ARM-based processors, and software really needs to kind of catch up there. But also what you said about, like, just integrating all those dual screen things that 10X was supposed to bring just into the system, like, maybe not a tablet mode, but maybe something that auto detects when you've got a dual screen, and then just the system itself knows how to adapt.
Let's look at this image Microsoft produced, by the way. Like, all we have is an image of, like, the Windows logo, and it looks like a set of windows and light is pouring through it. But
are we digging for clues?
That looks like two screens. That looks like light on the top and light on the bottom.
Okay.
Sandwiched together.
I see.
Yeah.
For the listener, you can go to Engadget.com to find DaVinci's article on this, which has the picture we're talking about. But
the image. Let's say Microsoft can be really cheeky at times. I don't know if you were following the industry when the first Surface was announced, Sherlyn, but they had this event in LA, and they had, like, the signage all around that just looked like weird. It looked like a tablet mashed with a keyboard, and, like, they were being very obvious about what they were building. So maybe they're being cheeky here too. I don't know.
Could be. I will say I am kind of excited. I don't want another event in my life, but I will say I am excited to see what Microsoft has to show. If just for a better ARM-based system, that's it. That's, like, if, I feel like that would be so exciting, because I will say I have recently just played with another Windows on ARM device, and, like, I noticed such obvious pauses and delays that I'm just like, look, I can't even.
You've reviewed all the Windows on ARM devices we've seen. And
I even offered to send you some so that you can, like, experience this for yourself. And you were like, nah.
I've tried the Surface Pro X. The Surface Pro X is really nice hardware, but Windows is just not ready to go to ARM. And let's be clear, like, the problems are right now a lot of software, 32-bit and 64-bit software, I think, just doesn't work well in ARM. They only recently added ARM, like, compatibility to run older apps into Windows on ARM. It's slow. the App Store stinks. Like, they don't have enough developers producing stuff on the App Store. So if you have a Windows machine, your habit is to, like, go to a company's website, download some software, and try to install it. You can't do that at all, I think, on the ARM devices. Everything has to go through the store. So
that's the thing. Yeah, that's the thing with change, is you're getting people to break their habits. And if you don't give them a good reason to do so, you're going to face a lot of resistance. And that's why Microsoft has to do better. It's just asking people to change habits, mm-hmm. but it's not provided an app store that's good enough for people to, like, rethink how they install apps.
It's so hard, though. Yeah, asking Microsoft users and Windows users to change. Especially. Well, look at Windows 8. Right? Windows 8 was like, ooh, everybody got a touchscreen, right?
Yeah. I will go on this soapbox. Hospitals in America still use XP or Vista.
Yeah.
That's how resistant to change people are. I'm getting red just talking about this. Anyway.
It's infuriating. Listen, I know the IT mindset, and the IT guy's mindset is, this works, this is stable, and it ain't broke, and, like, we don't need to move on until we absolutely have to. I think Windows 10 is actually a good upgrade for a lot of those things, but what happens with hospitals and other places is they're running weird apps for, like, all sorts of machines and different things where it's like, they can't upgrade because the XP compatibility is not great on Windows 10 or other things. So, hey, maybe they can fix that. Maybe they can, you know, I'm interested in seeing something new. I like Windows, and we talk about this stuff a lot. I feel like Apple gets all the software love, but what Microsoft has to do with Windows is tough. You have to make everybody happy. You have to, like, power the entire PC market, and you have to work with partners. You can't just, like, produce your own hardware and build around it like Apple does. Yeah.
True. I mean, I could see Microsoft just being like Apple and going like, nope, we're going to do this. And Dell, Asus, Acer, HP, you know, Samsung even. Yep. And y'all have to just listen and follow through. But
never going to happen.
They're probably not going to.
Yeah.
Speaking of its
partners, remember Windows 10S, by the way?
Oh, no.
Like, that was Windows 10S was Microsoft's attempt to be like, hey, everybody, we're like locking down Windows. It's going to be a little more secure. We're going to start doing it on our laptops. Nobody wanted it. Because if you buy Windows, again, you want to be able to use it like Windows and download apps from the web and stuff. So
we sound like we hate Windows, but to be clear, Devendra and I are both like my primary daily driver, even my work laptop. I was the one of two Engadget people to ever request a Windows PC for my work machine.
Yeah.
So there you go. But anyhow.
There you go.
There was other news too,
Speaking of like cool Windows machines, I think one of the other things, we didn't see many computers at Computex, but Alienware did take some time to unveil the X15 and X17 ultra-thin gaming laptops. And just shining these out, these things look really cool. They have the same like basic design of Alienware's M-series, which we've talked about. I reviewed those like early on, but they're even thinner. You know, they're like thinner, same. I think even potentially thinner than Razer's hardware, which for the longest time, like being the thinnest gaming laptop around, was like Razer's claim to fame. This is just Alienware going really hard on design, really going hard on thinness here. Are you excited by the idea of pretty thin gaming laptops?
I mean, we were just talking about this, but like, what is the weight here, really? I know you don't have the number offhand, probably. So I'm just kind of looking.
I don't think they released it yet either. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be interesting because the inch, like the profile here, we've got like 1.95 cm, which is 0.77 inches thick on the bigger, I think, 15 inch laptop. That's, I mean, twice what I'm used to. No, not really. Oh, twice what I'm used to, pretty much. So we'll still see. Am I excited? That's my answer, really, I guess.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. Like, I was on a call with Alienware folks about these things.
Yeah.
And somebody was just like saying, like, so what are we gaining by going thinner?
Exactly.
You know, what is the point of a thin gaming machine? And it's like the Alienware folks basically did the shrug emoji.
Right.
Because no, it's not making your system faster. It's not going to help with gameplay. It's not like a monitor upgrade. It's not like a processor upgrade. It is just like, hey, bro, it's thinner. That's cool.
Yeah.
And we can say we're thinner. And I do think that is annoying. Yeah, because these are at a premium, right? You're paying $2,000 to $2,100 for these things, whereas the M15 and M17 start at $1,400 to $1,600. So you're paying for thinness and design.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is some, like, I mean, technologically, it is impressive to keep going, you know, getting smaller components, keep making everything work in smaller packages. But when you're, you know, fighting to get to, like, this is a numbers game, right? You're just trying to get you under an inch thick or something, whatever, which is very impossible. But then you like you said, sacrifice other things, like you introduce flex for one, or how are you going to fight against flex on something that thin?
Or cool, like it's heat. It's really heat with gaming thermals. Laptops is the problem.
Yeah. And like, but outside of the gaming laptop world too, mainstream laptops are also trying to go thin and light. And one thing that also gets sacrificed is keyboard depth. And
battery life.
Battery life.
Yeah.
And therefore like the thermal stuff too. So I think, like, philosophically, I'm there for the technological advances, and I think eventually we'll get to a day where, like, our laptops are all, like, pieces of paper. They're so thin, you know, and light. But do I think we've already gone really far and are pretty okay? I think so. I mean, like, they're not too bad, so, you know.
I think we've kind of hit, at least in terms of gaming laptops, we've hit the point of diminishing returns, and I talked about the Asus Zephyrus G14 last year. That thing weighs 3.5 pounds, you know, and is super light. The G15 weighs, I think, like 4.2, which is the one we reviewed this year. And though, like that, to me, that is thin and light and portable. I'd be really interested to see the weight on the X15 and X17. But, you know, if you don't support this idea, don't buy it. There are so many other systems you can buy. Live, especially if you're buying a gaming laptop. You're probably better off getting something that's slightly heavier, that has better cooling, that can last a lot longer too, because gaming hardware, if you're playing it all the time, it's getting hot, that stuff degrades. You know, the thermal grease degrades, like the ability for a computer to cool itself gets worse over time. So I think in a couple of years,
I want to point out that our executive editor, Aaron Suporis, is in the chat answering questions where I believe Peanut Air did say that maybe there are some gamers who carry those monstrosities around every day, so making them thinner makes some sense. So, you know, that has a point. Sort of. But
that's what backpacks are for. Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. But also, Aaron, like I said, pointed out that the Alienware X series is so thin that they had to remove all the ports from the side. Not sure that's what the gamers want. Unless you're full wireless on your accessories, and also let's not forget the lag and the latency with wireless. Yeah. Exactly. Like, you need these connectors. You need these ports. So what are you sacrificing?
Yep.
It's definitely point of diminishing returns is the perfect way to put it, Dev. I like it. Speaking of perfect way to put things, by the way, Devendra, I love how when you talked about Dell's executives responding, you said they did the shrug emoji instead of saying they just shrugged. This is how you think of life now. You just think in emoji.
No, it's like they literally threw their hands up.
It was like, that's a shrug. They shrugged.
I think it's funny when real life absolutely reflects online life. Yes. So, yeah, it's like when people start saying LOL instead of just saying they laughed, you know?
I say LOL. But
I never say that.
No, I don't. I troll to say that. speaking of trolls. I think we had one other piece of news this week that was kind of interesting.
Great, great segue into this. We did see the news this week, and I had the joy of writing it up. Donald Trump's online platform, aka his Blogspot blog, is dead. And I think that is it's just hilarious. And I don't know. I had a little fun writing this too, because it's just this thing doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. But it is funny that a guy that existed so much to spew, you know, everything he wanted to say, just like put it out there on Twitter, put it out there on YouTube. Once he had a blog and he had to like sit there and write down things and get it shared without having the sharing mechanisms of social networks, he just couldn't do it. I think it was really funny. The Washington Post reports that Trump basically ordered to kill the blog after they and a lot of other places reported that it had really dismal traffic. Like, it was like nobody was really there reading it compared to other places. And just the way it was programmed too. I remember people were trying to share things. Links would break. You couldn't share videos properly. Like, things didn't share themselves properly to social networks. Just kind of hilarious. Where do you think, Shalyn, now that Donald Trump has, you know, tried and failed blogging like so much else in life, where do you think, you know, he's going to try and fail next?
drum roll, please. TikTok. I was gonna do like boom chik bow, and then I was like, that's not the right sound. And then yeah. But I don't know. I think he's gonna find the platform that hasn't turned him away yet. So I mean
Well, he did spend a lot of energy trying to kill TikTok in the US.
Right, so he did. The beautiful irony will be that he's gonna try to get on TikTok, and then they're gonna be like, nah, fam. I love the picture
I absolutely believe. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I love the picture you chose for your article on this, by the way. It's just Donald Trump making the gesture with his fingers of something very small
gesture, and the caption is, that's him measuring his blog's traffic.
Yep.
But
so I actually saw something pretty interesting just before we started recording. Mm-hmm. So Casey Newton, the guy who writes the Platformer newsletter, talked a little bit about this in his issue today. And so I want to read a little bit of something that he wrote about this. It said, after months of Trump-free Twitter, the platform's value to him has been more clear than ever. Tweets are simply more powerful than posts on a website. They can be reshared to a global audience with a single click. They can attract new followers by the millions and set the agenda for many of the world's prominent journalists. Trump's rapid retreat from blogging highlights the degree to which he depended on free reach, not free speech, to advance his malign agenda.
Great line.
That is the... Yeah. Yes, and that is the big, big important thing here. It is free reach that he really gets out of these platforms, and especially from Twitter, because let's be real about it, and I literally have this in my Twitter bio, it is a sassy LinkedIn for journalists.
Sure.
It is literally just where news people spend all day, and so that's where he got the most eyeballs of the people who controlled media narratives, and they would just like... spread whatever he was talking about that day for free. If people actually need to go to his site to see whatever things that he has to say, instead of having it served to them just passively, it is a totally different ballgame. And I think this is something that we need to think about in terms of other people who just exist for attention in the future. Is this a path toward deplatforming and seeing how whether or not deplatforming people actually is effective, then there needs to be whole benchmarks of who gets deplatformed and why. it gets very complicated.
And that goes back to like a lot of, I think, like white supremacists and other folks, like notable folks, like was it Milo Yiannopoulos, who were also banned on networks, and we don't hear from them anymore. They're gone.
Yeah, no, there are people who might be saying to you, who is Milo Yiannopoulos now?
Good.
If you were on
Good.
Twitter in 2014 or 2015, you knew exactly who this guy was.
Yep, absolutely. Let me just read a statement. If you were waiting, by the way, for Trump's online platform to launch, do not worry. His senior aide, Jason Miller, said the blog, which was just a blog, from the desk of Donald J. Trump, it was just auxiliary to the broader efforts we have and are working on in terms of details for next, whatever the next project is. He's hoping to have more information on the broader effort soon, but I do not have a precise awareness of timing. These people have a way with language of failure. Just gotta say, like it is. I do love the way they frame all this stuff. But hey, maybe the Donald Trump social network is going to happen in sometime soon, and it'll also be hilarious.
Well, I mean, they're taking, speaking of tech, they probably take a lot of cues from tech. You know, there's no such thing as messing up. You're just failing forward.
That's, just put that on his tombstone. Let's move on to what we're working on. Trillin, what's up? What's up? I know you're coming off of a week of vacation, which is well-deserved, but also vacation means more work in other ways, right?
Yeah, I'm digging myself out of this vacation hole, which is like catching up on the hundreds and hundreds of emails, which I still haven't fully gotten around to doing because I'm still trying to test.
You don't just like highlight everything and say I do that, but I kind of have to read.
So I like I highlight everything and I'm like, okay, is this Marcus? Like I had to like filter. Anyway, doing that plus testing a new system plus prepping for WWDC, which is Monday next week. Monday? June 7th, whenever that is, Tuesday. Getting ready for that. But I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that the summer will be a bit slower after June. Because I know all the way till the end of June we're pretty slammed. But
that's
hopefully tech company event planners, listen to me. Dear please. God, please do not schedule
give us
any more of
August
it.
At least. Yeah. Yeah.
Clear July and August. Just let's all take a break. Let's not introduce anything for a while. Go. Mm-hmm. Let's all everybody go to rest. So that's me just praying very hard for the next 2 months to be empty. How about you?
Cool. I am so the things I mentioned, I'm working on that Asus ROG Strix review. I really like the benchmarks I'm seeing so far because this thing is actually outpacing the 3080 in some benchmarks and some games. But again, I think ray tracing is going to be the weakness for AMD at this point. And I'm also simultaneously working on a review for the 3070 Ti, which is going to drop sometime next week. Let's move on to our picks. How about that? And yes. I'm really interested in hearing what's up with your picks.
Well, I think you're interested because I have to publicly go on the record and tell everyone you were right.
I just like it when Sherlyn says that. So that's all.
You recommended, I think, 2 weeks ago, the Nevers. And you know, you've been also like offline telling me to go watch it, and I like went and watched it during my time off. It's amazing. It's really good. It's like a cross between like Penny Dreadful, Miss Peregrine's House for Extraordinary Children. I think that's the title, plus X-Men.
Plus X-Men.
Plus X-Men. I really liked it. I think that if anyone here still hasn't seen it, the whole first half of the first season is up on HBO Max. Mm-hmm. And all the things you pointed out about having a different showrunner, maybe changing maybe the second half of the season, could be worth thinking about. But right now, it's like a fun ride. And I'm really excited for more.
I rewatched, by the way, the second half of that series again with my wife, and she was also similarly impressed. Like
the second half is really cool.
Right,
because you didn't like the first few episodes yourself.
I think episode two was weak.
Right.
Episode two was a little weak because the pilot was great. Right. But beyond that, like everything was good. Yeah.
I liked all of it, and I haven't like rewatched in like very seriously yet. But no. Anyhow, it's a really cool show about like. Not mutants, but sort of superhero-y mutant
superpowers.
Type. Yeah, superpowers, and like the whole theme is very similar to X-Men, but you know, like this is an evolution. This is a whatever. Anyways, if you're interested in that sort of stuff set in the Victorian era, I guess, go check it out. But my, I've been watching a lot of shows that I'm saving for future episodes to tell you guys to watch. But for now, this week I thought it would be the time to go on a ramble about more food stuff. Because the last time I recommended to you guys, it was about food. Yeah. This time around, I am telling you guys to check out the app called Too Good To Go. It's actually, I believe, not really a foundation, but it's a website as well as like an Android and iOS app called Too Good To Go. Basically, it's a movement or some sort of project, right? Where these people have teamed up with restaurants to sell the food that they have left at the end of the day for a much cheaper price to people near them. And it tackles food waste, which, like, imagine if you weren't, like, if a restaurant that's not the size of, say, a chain, like, I don't know, Chili's, Denny's, TGI Fridays, whatever, right? Those chains, I believe, have their own programs to manage their food waste and that sort of stuff. But like smaller, like independent restaurant owners don't generally have that. So if they prepare food ahead of time, if you watch a lot of Kitchen Nightmares like I do, you know that like food waste, rotting food in the kitchen is no good. So anyway, what you can do with the app is, and this is, I'll tell you why I'm recommending this later, but the way you can do in the app is you check out what restaurants are in your area. And I found like surprisingly a lot of restaurants near me are participating. You can sign up and reserve a bag. So they have these surprise bags that you can pick up at the end of the day or at a certain mealtime of leftover food and pay a fraction of the price you would otherwise pay for a meal like that. So like a lot of the bags are like $3.99, $4.99 instead of the usual $10 to $11 for a meal that size. And yeah, you can pick it up at like times that are good for you, 8:30, 9:30, usually end of day. I'm seeing a lot of those times. I haven't actually picked up a bag myself yet just because like I'm not really buying, eating out a lot. But if you are looking for a way to like try something new and like you don't want to spend too much money eating out all the time, I think this could be good if you're willing to take a gamble on what like food restaurant might offer.
Because you don't know what you're going to get, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You never really know. I mean, if you are worried about allergens and stuff like that, you can call up the restaurant and be like, hey, you know, you make a reservation, you call up the restaurant and be like, hey, I'm, you know, dairy-free or I can't have nuts, and then see if the bag has any of that stuff and probably get none of that in your bag. That's anyway.
That's cool.
The other thing I was going to suggest is if you're looking to try a different cuisine this week, you can try Portuguese food. I miss Portugal so much. But the reason I got on this app, the path that took me down installing this app for myself, because I've seen the ads on Instagram too, but was that I was like, looking at old pictures, I was like, oh, I miss Portugal and Portuguese food. So I was like looking up Portuguese restaurants in my neighborhood. And then somehow like I found a review that said, oh, I found this place through Too Good To Go. And so that's when I installed it. And like, it's just, I'm obsessed with food. So y'all are going to hear a lot of food recommendations from me. Just deal with it. But this is at least sort of tech related and somewhat helpful, I think. So anyway, yeah, enjoy. Nice.
I miss good Portuguese food, by the way. Like, that is one thing. I've never been to Portugal, but so growing up in New England, there are a lot of, like, Portuguese families there who make, like, a lot of different foods. So, used to have family friends who would make stuff all the time. Good food. Thank you for the food, Rex Sherlin.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk offline about all the food. What about you? Okay. What are you going to tell people to watch this week?
I want to tell, listen, so there's this crazy movie called Riders of Justice, which is I believe it's a Danish film directed by, trying to look up the names here, directed by Anders Thomas Jensen, starring my man, Mads Mikkelsen, who I love. And this movie is so weird. I'm not going to spoil much of what happens. I think the basic setup is like a Taken revenge action thriller, but it's also a comedy. Sort of. It's also like a weird like Christmas fairy tale at times. It is sort of like if you take a Taken movie and you add, and this is probably dating me, but like the nerds from the X-Files, like the lone gunman. So it's like a Taken movie plus you have like the computer hacker and like the just a bunch of computer nerds who are also like in this thriller movie too. It is hilarious. It is weird. I think it kind of like flips the action revenge genre on its head a little. And also, Mads Mikkelsen, always great. Always great. I love everything this man does. Check out Another Round on Hulu, which I think is one of the best movies I've seen in a very long time. I believe it won the Oscar for best. Did it win best international film? Anyway, amazing film. Mads Mikkelsen is fantastic. Check out Riders of Justice. I think it's worth renting. Also want to shout out a show which I think you will really love, Sherlin. It is called Girls by Veva.
I saw ads for this.
Yeah. It's on Peacock, which is, I hate saying the name Peacock, which is like NBC's, you know, the streaming thing. You can watch a bunch. This is a show about basically a girl group like the Spice Girls from the 90s who had like one hit and then failed. And then it's about like who they are now. And them as like older people coming back and trying to like make a mark in the world and maybe make some music. It is really funny. You know, I think it stars Sarah Bareilles. Busy Phillips, a lot of people I really enjoy. It's produced by Tina Fey and Robert Carlock. So it has that sort of like 30 Rock vibe. It's just really funny. It's like a musical comedy with a great cast. And you can watch a bunch of episodes free on the Peacock app if you don't mind some ads, and if you subscribe to Peacock, which I don't know if I'd recommend anybody do that, then you can watch everything. But I think it's a lot of fun. It's really good. Peacock weirdly has become the service that that has a lot of like secretly good comedies. I forget if I talked about this, but the Saved by the Bell reboot is actually fantastic. So, and nobody expected that, but you can only watch it on Peacock. It's just so weird.
Interesting. I think Discovery Plus also has a lot of random stuff that like I kind of want to watch because of the Food Channel stuff, the Food Network, sorry, stuff.
Exactly.
All of these little streaming apps and their little niches, dang. And that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you as always for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter or chat about movies and TV at the /filmcast at /film.com.
If you want to just randomly tweet me pictures of really awesome looking food, I'm at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
Hey, this is Terrence O'Brien, managing editor at Engadget and resident music nerd and music tech reporter. I recently had the opportunity to sit down and interview Alessandro Cortini, who is an amazing musician and composer, and who you might know from his contributions to Nine Inch Nails, of which he is a touring member, as well as Tony Rolando from Make Noise Music, a synthesizer company based out of Asheville, North Carolina, that tends to specialize in things that are a little bit strange and experimental. The two of them came together recently to collaborate on a new synthesizer called the Strega. It is a very unique, very strange instrument. It's a tiny desktop synthesizer that's $600 and basically doesn't sound anything like any of the other tiny, affordable desktop synthesizers out there. So this isn't a Volca. This isn't even something like a Korg Minilog. This is its own weird, unique beast. So we had a very long, sprawling conversation about what it was like to collaborate on it, what the vision was going into building the Strega, and kind of how Alessandro came to make the jump from creating music with synthesizers to designing his own. So don't miss it. You want to stick around and check this out. All right. So joining us today, we have Tony Rolando from Make Noise and Alessandro Cortini, an accomplished musician, composer, and you also might know him as a touring member and contributor to Nine Inch Nails. Thank you both for joining us today and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start a little bit by talking about Make Noise in general. Tony, can you tell me a little bit about the company, where you guys are based, what you do, that sort of thing?
Yeah, Make Noise is based out of Asheville, North Carolina. That's in Western North Carolina. We've been here for approaching 20 years now, I think. Actually, maybe closer to 15. We design and build mostly modular synthesizers, but we've also been making some standalone musical instruments, such as the Strega, where we collaborated with Alessandro Cortini to create an instrument that is spiritually connected to his artistic output. We spent about 2 years trying to capture a glimpse of his magic and put it into a box that other people could create with. That's our most recent project, but we've also developed a full system of modular synthesizer modules. So for example, the DPO, Optimix, Maths, the Morphogene, Mimeophone, where we collaborate with Tom Erb, Soundhack, and also the shared system, which is probably the thing that we're maybe most known for, I guess, outside of something like the Strega or the Zero Coast.
Mm-hmm. And is there like a core aesthetic that you guys kind of strive for? Is this, I guess, like what's the connecting thread between all of these pieces?
Well, it's changed over the years. Being a company for 15 or so years, really, you know, in the beginning, I had been working for Moog Music, which are also based here in Asheville. And I kind of struck out on my own to attempt to develop PCBs, printed circuit boards for other companies. But most companies didn't want to hire me because I didn't have any kind of portfolio. So I started developing my own printed circuit boards, and that kind of led to developing modules. And initially, I was deeply inspired by the work of Don Buchla. And at that point, it was very, I guess it was just a different time. All of that stuff just seemed very magical and mysterious because no one was really talking about it so much. And it wasn't really, it was just this whole world of synthesizers that I had really only seen pictures of. But then, you know, becoming friends with Alessandro gave me the opportunity to play and be in the same room as some of those instruments. And that kind of opened up that world a little bit more. So yeah, initially it was just a deep inspiration of the work of Don Buchla. But today it's very different. Today it's developed into something entirely different that would be maybe beyond the scope of this program to describe, honestly. Because now I feel like we really thrive mostly on collaboration. So such as the bit that we've just done with Alessandro, but then also looking at the Morphogene, Mimeophone, Echophone, the things that we've done with Tom Erb, which are also collaborations in a similar manner to what the Strega is with Alessandro. I feel like that's maybe where the more exciting part of Make Noise is for me, at least. I really enjoy collaborating with these folks.
And Alessandro, how did you first connect with Tony and the Make Noise team? How'd you guys end up starting to work together?
Well, I connected with Tony at the beginning of Make Noise, because I remember buying, I think, the first one of the first batch. What was it? Was it a mod? It was the ring mod, the passive.
Oh, you had
mod.
The mod? Yeah. I didn't know you had one of those, honestly.
Yeah, I bought it from Sean.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's when I became familiar with Make Noise. And then, you know, from a user's point of view, I followed, you know, up to the QMMG. And I think shortly after that, you know, obviously the QMMG, just to make it easy for people, it's a reinterpretation of an essential core element in the Buchla modular, which is the low-pass gate. But unlike a lot of the other low-pass gates that I had seen, which were simply not even an adaptation, but a copy of what Don had done with, you know, components that weren't as expensive or, you know, in that format, Tony, from the beginning, from a design point of view, give me the impression of being someone who could digest the information or things that he really loved, and he was able to repurpose them and represent them digested. And you know what I mean? Like, like he really was able not to cover up, but just really digest, analyze, and process in a personal way what somebody else's inspiring idea might have been. And that I think was the base of what really, you know, connected me with Tony and Kelly's work at Make Noise, was the fact of presenting something very unique with, you know, a tip of the hat to the people that really inspired me with music instrument making, without feeling like it was, you know, a copy, because it never felt like it was a copy. There was always an entity, both from a graphical and a sonic point of view, that makes, you know, the company and the sound that to me is the Make Noise sound. I can't remember exactly. I think we met at a show. It must have been a show for sure. Like, it must have been a trade show. But we clicked right away, both with Tony and with Kelly. And I think that my connection with them is equal due to, obviously, what Tony is from a professional point of view and how he does that. But just as much as a person, I feel like very connected with Tony and Kelly from a friendship point of view. And they're really a family to me. And we've always felt like a connection that wasn't based on, oh, let's make something together. In fact, I think we've known each other longer as friends than we had collaborators. And but I think essential to the, I think to the, you know, to the success, and I'm not talking about the, you know, the success of the collaboration as in coming up with something we're both happy with, I think that was an essential part of it. You know, the fact that Tony and I, from a creative point of view, Tony had already created things like the, you know, the CV bus in the case of his modular of the shared system that was designed to help me to utilize the shared system live in a better way, with color coded CV signals that would allow me to, you know, to redistribute CV signals around even in a dark stage, assigning colors, blinking colors, or, you know, like lit colors to specific signal, so I would know that, for example, green would be pitch for me, or gates would be red. You know what I mean? It'd be very easy on a dark stage. And from there on, I mean, I think we had a project that we kind of labeled the Ghost Synth back in the day that we did together with another friend of ours, Scott Yeager, that never really went anywhere. But it was always easy for us to talk about stuff like this. Like, and it really felt like, you know, like an instrument design version of being in a band, really. in a very natural, I mean, I'm sure probably there's been more, you know, labored moments for Tony that have been for me, in the sense that to me it was always very exciting to talk about these things. And, you know, I would probably bring up things that, you know, to do that Tony was like, what, you even know what that means? But I think that also my inexperience from a design point of view allowed Tony to approach things from a you know, from an angle that he might have not considered if you were to analyze mm-hmm. them simply from a design point of view. You know what I mean? Mm. So that is a long sort to say that I don't think, you know, a long way to say that I don't think there could have been a better way for this collaboration to start. I mean, there was friendship, there was a mutual respect for what we did, and an ease of communication, you know? So I think, right now, looking back, it's like, well, no wonder we were able to do something like this. I think all the ingredients were there to begin with. Mm-hmm.
So I guess it makes sense. You've been friends for a while. It sounds like you've collaborated in the past on a smaller scale before moving on to the Strega. At what point did you guys decide we're going to build a full on instrument together? We're going to like work on this bigger project? Was there a moment, or was it just something that kind of gradually emerged out of other conversations?
All I remember is conversations of what would you, I mean, I think, and Tony, tell me if I'm romanticizing or connecting dots or not there, but what I remember is Tony's interest, not much in the instruments that I use, but what I was getting out of the instruments that I was using. Like, so like, for example, when you saw me playing with the easel, he wouldn't ask questions about the easel itself. It was more about the process and how I was getting certain things out of it. Same thing about the, you know, some fuzz or distortion pedals, or same thing about delays, and same thing about the EMS synthy. So I think the way that I interpret it is that once Tony saw how I behaved in front of instruments, to him it became interesting the plan of creating a canvas that would allow me to feel that way, to behave that way. You know what I mean? To basically not so much copying an element of each synth, but more put Alessandro in a position where it'll behave the same way. You know? Mm-hmm. So why is he behaving that way? We know that you can't just take an element out of a synth and repurpose it and you won't behave the same way, because an instrument is a collection of different things put together in a certain way. But the short answer is, I think 3 years ago, I think in New York, we were in a macrobiotic restaurant, and I remember we were sketching down ideas, the first ideas of what an instrument could be. And again, the thing I want to underline is that there's never been any sort of pressure on or feeling that we had to do it at a certain time. It almost felt like it was always refreshing and exciting to know that we were going to talk about it, because we knew that there was no deadline. It was like, let's see if it might happen. But there wasn't like, oh, we got to do this, we got to make sure that it sells, obviously there was, I'm assuming from a company point of view, a responsibility and feeling that, you know, that there would be something that people might relate to. But also, I think the moment that Tony asked me, do you realize this thing is very noisy? And then we said yes and continued. From there on, he was ready for any sort of consequence.
Well, no, that restaurant was Angelica's Kitchen. I don't know if you've ever been there, Terrence. It unfortunately no longer open. It had been open since the 70s, though, which it was a wonderful restaurant. But to the point, I think the key there is that this idea that there was no pressure or deadline. And I really don't think there was. And I like that, because I feel very strongly that we have a lot of synthesizers in the world today. There are a lot of synthesizers currently available. And to me, I feel that there's no sense in developing something new unless it truly deserves to be added to that pile that we already have. And so I think you have, and the only way to do that is time. You have to develop ideas and then you have to destroy them. I mean, you can't just make the first thing you come up with. You have to just keep developing and developing and retooling revising until you come up with something that is truly unique and wonderful and worthy of being put out into the world. Because one thing I don't want my name attached to is producing tomorrow's landfill. You know, it's just, there's no sense in it. I mean, Jesus, you can open up Reverb right now and throw a dart and hit, you know, some random $200 analog synthesizer, and half of them will sound very similar to each other. So you really can't lose if you just want that basic 80s analog synthesizer sound. So I feel like we did achieve that with the Strega. I don't think there's a lot to compare it to, which is a positive thing in my opinion. Now, is it for everybody? Definitely not, because as Alessandro has mentioned, it is quite noisy. It is not a universally applicable instrument. You no one's going to say, "Oh, I think I need a good funky bass sound," and turn to the Strega. Now, somebody might. It'd be a wonderful challenge, but I don't think that it's something that somebody would go to when they're looking for that kind of sound. And many other sounds, there's many sounds that you cannot do well, in my opinion, with the Strega. But the sounds that you can do well with the Strega, I feel strongly that you'd be hard pressed to find something that could do those sounds better. So I really like that it has that quality.
Yeah,
the other thing. Sorry, I wanted to add. Yeah. It's also
go ahead.
The one thing that we strive to achieve was also the more passive approach, as opposed to, like Tony said, when someone goes and tries to get a bass sound, like wants something and tries to get out of an instrument. There was the whole point of sitting in front of a machine that stimulated a two-way conversation, because a lot of the machines that I was inspired by were like that. They looked or felt like a toys, didn't make me feel responsible or didn't make me feel like I had to learn. I felt creatively explorative about the instrument. And then a spark came out, and then I knew what to do. Yeah. And I really like that. I like the fact that it's not a job that, all right, I know that some people might approach it that way and not feel like it's a job. But when you sit and say, I want to create a bass with that, there's a certain amount of structure that I'm not too fond of, you know, from a creative point of view. Yeah. I like to sit in front of stuff and see what comes out. Why? Mm-hmm. Because I've done it long enough that something comes out all the fucking time anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know what I mean? It doesn't have to be, and I'm not saying that everything's gold, but I'm saying I'm creative all the time. So if there's a machine that makes me even more creative and it makes me feel good, something cool will come out and it'll make me feel good about it. And then the more you do it, the more you're able to go back to the more active process of the more you know the machine, the more you know what you can get out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think it was definitely a priority for us to create something that would make us feel creative, you know, and spend hours, even if you don't make music, to feel relaxed and enjoy the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And talking about that sort of idea of, I don't like the word passive necessarily, but like what you're saying, like, you sit down and something comes out. You don't sit down necessarily with the idea of making a bass. And I'm very much in that same mindset. Like, I love the idea of just sitting down and seeing what comes out and exploring it.
Yeah.
But would you go so far as to call Strega like a happy accident machine? Because I feel like that does have like a certain connotation, and I don't know if that's, and those are often two kind of worlds, like sit down and see what comes out, but also the sort of unpredictability and difficulty of recreating something that comes with like that, like sort of happy accident, just do whatever.
Yeah, to a certain extent I would, but not, I mean, a lot of the machines that we used as a, I don't want to say reference, but that I used before were taking that aspect to the extreme.
Mm-hmm.
When it came to the Strega, I think what Tony tried to do was to extrapolate what made those machines behave the way that they want in a more, as far as was possible, more controlled way, because the one thing we wanted to take out was the frustration that sometimes can come from machines that have a certain age or they're designed in a certain way while retaining the juice, you know, retaining why we liked those machines. For example, one thing, and I'm sure Tony will agree, was the overdrive stages in the Synthi, the fact that every stage can be overdriven. Tony has spent an immense amount of time finding a way to integrate the discourse in the Strega in a way that made sense, you know, where stages could be overdriven both at the input or the output, you know, and for it to be musical in a way that never sounded, you know, bad, essentially, you know, while in the Synthi, you can make it sound bad. You know, it takes a very small turn and bad is bad. You might want bad one time, but not many times. You know what I mean?
I'll tell you, I got a Synthi, and I'll be honest, mostly because of Alessandro and Delia. And I have to say, that is one of the most frustrating instruments I have ever owned. It is very hard to make a Synthi sound good, in my opinion. And maybe it's just me, I don't know. But it is really hard. It's one of those things, you know, you play a music easel, and I really feel like I can make a music easel sound beautiful. But when I have tried to play the Synthi, I have never had the kind of results that I hear from Alessandro or Delia Derbyshire and other people who play that instrument. It's just, it is such a hard instrument to make sound great.
Well, and I think, you know, and the goal, thank you. But I think the goal with the Strega was the same thing, to figure out how could we create a canvas that would be, because there was a little bit of a fear. Two fears, mostly. One, that people wouldn't get it, and two, that people would all sound like me. There'd be a box that would make everything sound like. Not that I feel like I have that much of a, you know, identity, but you know, there are musical factors that might make you think, all right, it's out of tune. It repeated for a half hour. It sounds like Cortina. But you know what I mean. And so we were pleasantly, because I don't think, and Tony might be disagreeing with this because he's the one that actually designed the thing, but I don't think there's a way to be 100% sure that you're creating something that people can relate to. It's just not possible.
It's hard. Yeah.
And so when we started putting together this compilation of promotional compilation for the Strega, which will come out in July, and we started sending it out to friends, you know, like Marta Saloni, Caterina Barbieri, Hiro Kone, Ben Frost, Juliana Borwick. We started getting these artists through the Strega. We didn't get, you know, a forced version of themselves through an instrument that almost, you know, like it's much smaller than, you know, their entity. It felt like the Strega adapted 100% to who they were. Or at least they were able to integrate it in the way they were making music in a way that never felt forced, never felt like, you know, they were trying to please anybody, us or whoever. And it made us very happy. I mean, and it's also a very 360 spectrum. It doesn't feel like there is a Strega sound when you listen to those 10, 15 tracks. It feels like you hear it's the Strega, obviously, but it doesn't feel like it's a one-way, you know, sonic colors.
Well, I have two thoughts on that. One is I feel that it does speak to the depth of any instrument when an artist can put their I'm not going to find the right words here, but when an artist can shine through an instrument, I feel like that speaks to the depth of the instrument. So for one. And, you know, the Strega is among many. There's many wonderful instruments out there where an artist can speak through them. But also, I feel like it speaks to the quality of artist, because I actually do think it would be easy for somebody to do something with the Strega that had the Strega sound. But I think that the real, like, for me, artists of a certain merit, when they reach a level where they just know that that's not how they're going to shine through, they're going to speak to the listener more if they find how to have their own soul shine through that instrument. And I think that's what you're getting Alessandra, with that compilation. You just, it just speaks to the caliber of artists that you chose to appear on the compilation. I think they
also,
all shine,
you know,
through.
Even the people you got, we sent it to demo it. I mean, like, Heimbach is a great example, because you know how Heimbach is such an inquisitive mind musically.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And you know that it's gonna, you know, but it's not gratuitously inquisitive. I don't think he reacts to everything. You know, I think that you have to give him stuff that yes. he can sort of like. It's like putting a rat in a labyrinth. There has to be cheese at the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And he's like sure. that. And when he did this thing on the Strega, the video, his experimentations with it. I mean, he came up with things that I didn't even think about. I mean, not that I could think of all of them, but like it was very informative. You know, like for example, using the envelope in loop mode as a second oscillator. That to me was awesome. You know what I mean? And he didn't really use what I like the Strega for the most, which is like long and dirty delays. He really likes short delays. So it was very interesting to see how someone who has that sort of thirst for discovery, what his search brought out in the same instrument that I love. You know, it was very, it's a very incredibly rewarding process to see people experience and explore the Strega, and it's something that I would have never anticipated, regardless of the fact that it, you know, that is a success, or it couldn't have not been. It doesn't matter. I think that I didn't think about what my reaction would be when I see people, you know, reacting this way and just going down, you know, a rabbit hole. I mean, I'm sure I will have to feel, you know, responsible for the annihilation of their social lives a little bit more, but then again, I think the last year probably took care of that anyway. So
absolutely. Yeah, you know, in talking about, you know, you're mentioning Heimbach, and you know, I also felt like Sarah Bell Reed really shone through. I mean, she sent me an EP that she recorded, and I mean, it didn't sound like the Strega at all to me, but it did sound incredible. It actually terrified me.
She's of nightmares. Talented.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But you know, maybe it's, you know, maybe one thing to touch on here then is that because the Strega doesn't conform to the modern, there's something about modern synthesizers where they try to be everything, you know, and you know, there's a market for that, and there's people that are looking for it, and I don't want to seem ungrateful, because I enjoy some of those instruments from time to time, but there's this idea that a synthesizer should be able to do everything. It should be able to recreate the sounds of the 70s, you know, Moog, Arp, and so on, the sounds of the 80s, you know, the Roland samples, wavetables, everything. And there's this idea that it should just be able to make a whole track and make all the different sounds that represent everything from like the 60s to present. And I think maybe because the Strega does not, you just even looking at it, it basically tells you, yeah, you know, you're not, this is not your universal key to the sounds of synthesis from the 60s to modern times. Maybe that attracts a certain type of artist such as Heimbach or Sarah Bell Reed or Ben Frost, and maybe they're more attracted to that quality than you know, potentially other types of artists would be. Go ahead.
I was gonna say no. I think you make an interesting point. This is a good moment if you're listening to the podcast instead of watching it. I apologize, but this is, I think, a good moment as any to actually like hold up the actual Strega and show like. What you're saying about this getting away from the modern synthesis thing and this trying to do everything, even like the terminology on the, and I keep bumping the microphone, I apologize. Even the terminology on the face of this thing is not your usual like modern synthesis terminology for the most part. Like we have the activation and what the looping envelope. What is the word we're using for that again?
We use no words for it, actually.
Yeah, I was gonna say, actually, it's not on here. It's called something in the manual, which I don't have in front of me.
but it's there.
Yeah. But yeah, you don't have there's no LFO, even though there is like a looping envelope.
I mean, the looping envelope is an LFO.
Yeah.
Yeah. That,
you know, there's a variable waveform, wave shaper essentially that allows you to have, you know, zero attack and a longer decay or vice versa, you know. It's a loopable AD, which basically turns it into a variable waveform LFO. I agree with you about the labeling, but also they're not, you know, they all make sense. You know, like if I look at the tonic, I know what it is. You know, it's activation. Once you turn it, you go, yeah, right. That's what it does. You know, I think it would have been harder to find, a standard term to label them, because some of the things that this machine does, other machines don't do it the way that this machine does. You know what I mean? And I hate to call it sucks that, but it's normal that you have to go through this process. But really, I think another thing that I wanted to bring up is the fact that once we announced it, everybody was sort of like complaining. A lot of people were complaining. Oh, it doesn't do this.
Really?
It looks like that. Yes, because we're in a society that judges by feature set. You know, we're reading about it in the photos. And once this ended up in people's hands, the tables turned immediately. And all of a sudden, it was sold out everywhere. You know what I mean? Because unfortunately, not a lot of people take the time to just to risk and make the investment and spend those $600 on it. I mean, you might think, oh, it's easy for you. Well, yeah, you know, I save up and buy stuff like everybody else. But if I don't click with an instrument, then I'll chuck it as an experience. I live with it for 6 months or whatever. Mm-hmm. I've learned something about myself in the process.
Yeah, yeah.
And move it on to somebody else. So I'll chuck those $200 as a 3 or 4 month rental fee. You know what I mean? I do it still to this day. If after 6 months, the piece of gear doesn't click with me, it goes out the window, you know, unless it's a vintage thing, obviously. That's a different category.
Well, the envelope generator you're talking about is called the agitation generator. I think we settled on some of these names because we were trying to promote this idea of the Strega experiment, this idea of taking some tonal elements and combining them and kind of creating a result that was potentially not, you know, just the sum of the parts, and that was deeply influenced by the circuitry that's inside. I think the idea of agitation is, you know, like if you put some different elements into a test tube and you agitate the test tube, it starts bubbling up or smoking or whatever. I'm not a chemist, so I don't know the exactly what's going on in there. But I do know that agitation is a method of creating some sort of a spark, some sort of response to combining some elements. So the agitation generator is essentially shaking up the mixture that you've done prior using the tonic and then time, you know, as time passes, the experiment, you know, the results change as time passes.
So actually let's walk through a few of the features for those who aren't 100% familiar with this yet. And unfortunately, I think our review is going to go up after this podcast does. I'm not sure what day yet. Ben, if you are editing this in the pod and the review is already up, please cut this part out. So let's take a little walk through some of the core feature set, because I think you know, we are in Gadget, we do care about specs. So like what are, you know, the features here? Like what are we walking through, like starting with the beginning of the signal chain, I guess?
Well, I think if you want to just get down to the spec, you know, if you wanted to make a spec sheet for the Strega, I think the key thing to think about would be that it is a complete synthesis voice. And that voice is not arranged in the classic Mini Moog style that nearly every analog synthesizer will be arranged in. So as opposed to VCO, into mixer, into VCF, into VCA, you would start with, there is a VCO that's represented by the tonic. It has variable wave shaping that is unlike other devices I've used in my lifetime. I mean, maybe there's something else out there that's similar, but I haven't used it yet. It's definitely not something that I would create for a module that Make Noise was going to do. It's a little bit too there's something about it that's kind of wrong, but works really well within the Strega. Outside of the Strega, I don't imagine we could create something like this and have people be happy with it. It's very unique to the Strega. So that's represented by the tonic and the tones controls. And rather than going into the rather than going into a mixer that's then fed into the filter, it actually goes to the VCA straight out. And so that's the activation section there, which is to the left of it. And that controls it animates the amplitude of that tone generator. Now, the other part of the equation is that there is an external input. So in addition to being a synthesis voice, it can also process external signals in numerous ways, obviously through the entire Strega, but also it's also capable of doing ring modulation, amplitude modulation, distortion, so a lot of different analog signal processing is useful in the studio. So that external signal is then mixed with the internal voice, the Strega tones, and then from there it goes into the part of the instrument that probably gives it the most character, which is a combination of several delay lines, a whole lot of feedback paths, and a multi-mode filter. And what's interesting about the Strega is that Alessandro and I really didn't want the echo verb, I'll call it, to just be an end of chain effect. And so that's why the controls are in the center of the instrument. It actually is not at the end of chain. The filter is at the end of chain. So, which again, it's just, I'm not saying it's some sort of incredible choice that no one else has ever made, but it is a unique choice in a hardwired synthesis instrument. And so putting that echo in front of the filter and having the filter be the output essentially is another thing that really defines the sound of the Strega. So it kind of sets it apart from your more standard VCO mixer, VCF, VCA. This one's it's like VCO, VCA, mixer, echo verb, filter, and then another mixer at the end. So it's kind of a strange combination.
The filter itself is really on the feedback. So it's like, it's not really at the end either. It's like
the filter is in two places. That's exactly. There's filters. There's actually multiple filters as well. Some of them, there are filter. There is a voltage control filter in the feedback path, but also at the output, another filter. And then there's also some non-voltage control filters. It's just, there's a lot of stuff happening inside there, but it's just the basic arrangement, I would say, is as I've stated it, which is again, in itself, kind of a strange combination of functional blocks that are just a little less typical than you would see in, you know, if you opened up a music store catalog today, with countless variations on the VCO, VCF, VCA. Not that there's anything wrong with that arrangement.
No, but Dr. in turn, Murphy. It definitely leads you to behave in a different way on the instrument, you know, because at the center, the bigger knob is the delay. So obviously, yeah. It's placed there and at that size because we want you to play with those three knobs as much as possible.
Yeah.
Because they're considered, you know, if a delay would be considered at the end of chain, then it'd be considered an effect. In this case, it's not an effect. And it's more of an essential part of what the sound should be on the instrument. You can or can bypass it if you want to, obviously. But the way that we envisioned it is just as important as the voice itself.
I mean, early on, I had a version without that final mix stage. There's the second mixer that I mentioned, which essentially allows you to bleed in some dry signal from the Strega tones and the external input. There was a big part of me that didn't even want to have that in there, but I felt like it could be creatively used, and I also felt like it might calm some people. To be able to have that blend of wet and dry, so to speak. But I mean, really, honestly, the Strega should be, I would say, you really need to be, you should just run it at like at least 70% wet at all times.
Well, it's always 100% wet. The only time that I, you know, open it and I go dry is when I tune it.
That's true. Actually, that is a really good point. It is a good, it is really useful for that.
Because... That's me. Because, you know, to me, it's more like, it's like going out naked. I will never go out naked. So why would I put the stereo with no effect on it? No soul in it. And
I agree
that the tones don't sound good, but actually I think the tones shine more through the Strega, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely. The Strega tones, like fully dry, is pretty harsh. Honestly, it's not a sound I would gravitate towards often.
Yeah. I mean, I've sampled it. I've used it quite a bit with the Waldorf, with the, you know, in the
quantum. Oh, with the quantum.
As original waveforms. For sure.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I can see that for sure. Because then you're going to be putting it through a whole other set of processes.
Exactly. Then it within becomes the quantum. An ingredient in another recipe, essentially.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. That's a great idea, actually.
I will just interject you to say that I do occasionally use the thing on full dry, but not for the Strega tones, just for processing external audio, because the overdrive is so good. Like, saying, that's... The synthy overdrive stuff. Especially on a guitar, man, it sounds phenomenal.
Can I ask you this, Terrence? Are you putting any sort of like buffer pedal in front of it, or are you just plugging just guitar straight into it?
Just guitar straight into it.
Ah, okay. What pickups do you have?
I've got a Fender Tornado. They're like atomic humbuckers. They're like super
high. Yeah, yeah.
Super hot humbuckers.
Yeah.
You can get just going straight dry and just cranking all the volume up all the way. You get some really great overdrive out of it. That's I will say, for anybody listening, there's another really good use for fully dry on the Strega.
Unfortunately, you're gonna, you know how the guitar world is. It's very, you know, I come from it, and unfortunately, there's very little. It's just a few of us that are trying to open the gates a little bit and try to, but it's just oil and water for the most part, from what I've noticed. You try to, you know, but you're right. And in fact, and I've used it the way that you say, and also at the base of the Strega itself, there was the need of also being a processor. So be able to run stuff through it and give it an entity, a personality, an identity, more than entity. So given an identity, a sonic identity that wasn't there before. And through the overdrive, through the delay and through the modulations and whatnot. And I think that's what, you know, also makes the Strega, you know, an ever changing entity. The fact that it's not just an instrument, it's not just synth. It doesn't pretend to be at all, but it can act as an active and a passive device. You know, it could be creating the sound, or it could just gently massage something else that comes in, or completely change it into something else. Like I say, leaving it under the water for 30 years and then fishing it out, you know.
I'll add real quick to guitar. If there are guitar players looking to experiment with it, I know from personal experience, if you are playing a guitar that has more like vintage, old school kind of pickups, like for example, I have a Stratocaster. I found that I really wanted to have some sort of a more standard guitar pedal in front of it, just to give it the right. Guitars pickups are just so picky about their input stage, and you're not so much with your nuclear humbuckers. Those don't care as much, but for the Stratocaster type thing, it definitely seemed like it benefited from having a pedal in front of it that could kind of buffer the pickup and let you get the full sound of that into the Strega, just in case, because it definitely thinned out a little bit. But then as soon as I used a pedal in front of it, it really let me drive the Strega hard and get the sounds that you're talking about.
I found in general, I have a Strat too, that just certain things don't play nice. Certain things, a Strat just sounds kind of weak and thin through. And like having like a good volume boost to pair with your Strat and anything, I just feel like is a good idea.
It really is, actually. When you say
weak and thin, that's kind of like what the Strat is.
Yeah.
I love
that.
Me, Leo Fender got it right first try with the Tele, and you know, well, maybe the jazz master, but Talley was, you know, he could have stopped there and it's like, done. There's nothing to reinvent. That's perfect.
That is, yeah, no, you're right. You're right. There is a place for that thin sound, though. I mean, there's so much.
Yeah, yeah,
music,
no, for sure. I'm sorry. Right. I don't mean to be offensive. I'm trying to make fun of it. I agree. No, definitely. But I never gelled. I've tried several strats. I own several strats and I never clicked. The Talley, I get a Talley and put it on, play it, and it's like, holy crap, done. Done.
Yeah.
Jazz Master, same way with the whammy. It's just like, yeah, makes sense. But, you know, they're very polarizing instruments in the sense that it's not like I don't like certain, it's like everything else, you know, but in the guitar world, like you can't play, you know, Gibson and Fender and Ibanez. People will, you know, people will
There's
burn
some great Ibanezes out there.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, I have plenty of Ibanez, plenty of, no, not plenty of Gibson, a few Gibsons, but Fenders and Ibanez, you know, but you can't. He's like, take your side, man.
You know what I used to play a lot of, I don't think I can find them as much anymore, was an Italian-made guitar, the Hagstrom.
Hagstrom is Swedish.
Oh, it's Swedish? Really? Oh, okay. I never knew that.
Have you ever met an Italian called Hagstrom? Alessandro Hagstrom? Luca Hagstrom?
I really liked those Hagstroms, though. They had a cool sound.
They came back, actually. They started making them again.
Did they?
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, in 2005. Aaron North, the guitar player for Nine Inch Nails back then, actually used the reissues, the Swede and the Super Swede, which were like the Les Paul style.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, they had, those things had some really hot pickups, or at least the ones that I had. Yeah, they like picked up radio stations. Hot.
Yeah. yeah, totally.
All right, so let's... wrap this up. Make Noise, the Strega is $5.99 available now. Yes.
Yeah.
And there is a compilation coming out. When is that coming out?
In July.
And then lastly, Alessandro, you have a new album coming out as well, right?
Yes. June 11th. So we're almost there. Less than 2 weeks.
And that is, the name of the album is?
It's Scuro Chiaro.
Okay. So I'm June 11th.
On June 11th. Very excited about that.
And there's also three singles from that album have already dropped, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, three singles and three videos that I've done with Marco Ciceri, which is an Italian director. Super happy so far with everything that has happened in association with the record. So I'm excited to release it and, you know, not play shows for it.
You guys, videos are on YouTube. Highly recommend checking them out.
Yeah, very check them out.
Yeah.
And I know there's beautiful. Strega on the album. Is there Strega on any of the singles, by the way?
Yes. There's there's Strega in Chiaroscuro, so the first piece. And not on the second, not on Lo Specchio, but on Verde, the last one that came out last week.
Okay.
Straight on that one, just because, you know, I mean, Tony, once prototypes started being made, I pretty much had one right away, you know, in the format that they were at the time. And obviously, what better way to test where we were at and what worked and what not than actually write and make music with it. So they were, you know, permanently wired to my system so I could actually, you know, be creative with them.
Yeah, so if you want to go hear the Strega in like a musical context outside of like demo clips on YouTube, go listen to Alessandro's new singles. Tony, Alessandro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.